Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Comics and Graphic Novels, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Woke, a host of the channel, and today I'll be talking to Dr. Paul Williams about his book, The U.S. Graphic Novel, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2022. Dr. Paul Williams is an associate professor of 20th century literature and culture at the University of Exeter in the UK. His research is centrally concerned with comics and graphic novels, and his monograph, Dreaming the Graphic Novel, broke new ground by explaining how graphic novels were published, circulated, and discussed in North America between the mid-1960s up to 1980. Dr. Williams has also co-curated an exhibition called The Great British Graphic Novel at the Cartoon Museum in London, which was visited by over 10,000 people. His book, The U.S. Graphic Novel, analyzes the ways that changes in the comics industry, book trade, and webcomics distribution have shaped the publication of long-form comics. The U.S. Graphic Novel pays particular attention to how the concept of the graphic novel developed throughout the 20th century. He looks at art historians, journalists, and reviewers, and how they have debated whether it was possible for a comic to be a novel, debates that accelerated after the term graphic novel was coined by a comics fan named Richard Kyle in 1964. This study underlines the proximity of the graphic novel to other media, showing that this cultural form is not only the meeting place between periodical comics and books, but that graphic novels are in dialogue with films, posters, and computer screens. In this interview, Dr. Williams talks about the sociological turn in comic studies, organized crime within the U.S. magazine industry, and other issues, and asks the question, who pays for online comics? So, Dr. Williams, welcome to the show. Paul, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, your intellectual or academic background, and how did it lead you to this project?
Thanks, Ellie. Thanks for having me on. I really began my career as a researcher, not working on comics at all. My early work was on war and the cultural construction of race and ethnicity. And so I wrote about things like hip hop and the war on terror. But I wrote a lot about the Cold War. So a lot of my early publications were about sort of the racialization of nuclear weapons and also sort of the way race and ethnicity played into people's vision of the world after a nuclear war. Now, that involved comics. So I did write a little about comics, but it was mostly other sort of forms of text and media, like novels and poetry, film and arts and speeches and popular music. So I've always researched comics, but to begin with, it was quite a small part of what I did. So around maybe 2005-ish, James Lyons said to me, who's now a colleague, whether I want to sort of edit a collection of essays and interviews with creators about American comics of recent decades. I said yes. And that became an editing collection called The Rise of the American Comics Artist in 2010. And that was the that's sort of the first thing that I published that had sort of my name on the cover that was about comics. And since then, I guess I've done more and more work on comics. And perhaps looking more at comics in terms of comics as an industry and fans and how fans respond to comics. So that's kind of the trajectory of the last, say, 15, 20 years. And part of that was a real focus on what I call the long 70s. So we're in perhaps the latter part of the 60s up to about 1980. And so I've done an awful lot of the research I do has been on American comics from that period. Partly this is a real pleasure for me because I'm just fascinated in this period. Things like the social change that took place, the various political crises. So I'm really sort of, I'm just fascinated by the 70s, basically. And as part of that, I'm interested in comics and their relationship with some of those, so that social, you know, that period of social change and those moments of, you know, particularly American political history. So some of the, sort of the articles and book chapters I've written have much more of that sense of comics letting us have discussions about, you know, politics and society in the United States in the 70s. But as I say, I am interested in the industry of comics. I'm interested in and the sort of reception of them. And so in 2020, I published this book called Dreaming the Graphic Novel, The Novelization of Comics. And what Dreaming the Graphic Novel did was go back to this period, 60s and 70s, and try to, well, tell the story of the graphic novel in that period. So as a term, it gets invented in 1964 by Richard Kyle, who was sort of a fan critic at the time. So Richard Kyle, in 1964, says they, you know, comics could be this thing called the graphic novel. And it could aim at different markets, and they could be longer. And that triggered a series of discussions amongst fans and then creators and editors and publishers about the graphic novel. So one of the things I did in Dreaming the Graphic Novel was look at this concept and see how all sorts of different stakeholders in the comics world discussed it, how they wanted to imagine what this thing might look like. And who it might be for, how it might be published. So part of what I did was try to reconstruct those discussions about what the graphic novel was and could be, at the same time doing some of that production history and looking at the industrial conditions that made the publication of actual graphic novels possible. So I was interested in things like the book publishing, you know, how trade publishing was changing in this period, how the comic book industry was changing, and other developments in things like magazines. A combination then of this sort of production history, a reception history about the graphic novel in the 60s and 70s. And I suppose having done that, why not keep going? And go all the way back in history and up to the present and write a book called The US Graphic Novel, which is not a million miles away from that earlier book on the 60s and 70s. So what I tried to do with The US Graphic Novel is tell the story of long comics narratives in the United States. I look at industrial conditions. So I look at how over, you know, different moments in, I know the production of text leads to long comics narratives. I also try to think about different reception. The different reception of graphic novels. So how people at different times, maybe it's art critics, maybe it's fans, maybe it's book reviewers, how they're all have their own kind of perception of what this thing might be. And I also
That's a bit different, actually, to the early research. It's trying to put this idea of the graphic novel in conversation with the study of other media and think about how the storytelling that is possible in a long comic narrative is how that is in dialogue, not just with comics, but also with other forms of media. You know, how reading a graphic novel might... There might be some sort of dialogue with looking at a computer screen, with seeing a poster on the streets, seeing a silent film. So one of the things I try to do is both tell the story of the graphic novel, again, still thinking about production and reception, but also that conversation with other media that's going on. So that's kind of how I got up to write this book, the US graphic novel.
Great. I love that you're a glutton for punishment. You did this big project and came back for another big project. Perfect. We appreciate it. So I think the U.S. graphic novel was a huge undertaking. You bring in so many different sources and so many different perspectives. So what was, for you or in the general process, what was difficult about writing a book that covers more than 100 years to get to this topic?
Yeah. And that's the nutshell, really. It's this huge body of, more than a century of these texts called graphic novels. Not always called graphic novels. One of the things that I did want to track in the book is the way the word novel comes up again and again. And though the idea that you'd call a long comics narrative a graphic novel, though that might be coined in the 1964, it's the idea that you could call a long comic a novel is really goes back all decades and decades. So one sense is that creates so many texts you can write about. Now, it's seven chapters. I think maybe the first four go up to the end about 1980. In some ways, though it was easier when fewer graphic novels were published. That was because then you can kind of have, you can be a lot more confident that the story you're telling is sufficiently focused and is doing justice to the debates and the possible relationships between other media and what's happening with the production of these long comics narratives. Basically the book got harder and harder to write as each chapter went on, because you're working your way up to the last, say, 30, 40 years, in which, I doubt anyone has read all of the graphic novels published in the last 40 years. So there would have been up to a certain cutoff point, that would have been possible. You know, someone could claim, probably rightly, oh, I've read every graphic novel ever published. I think that now is out the window, just because so much is published, and that's the hard bit. So how do you organize and find coherent narratives out of this huge burgeoning graphic novel scene? How can you create something that is both reflective of these all these different sorts of graphic novels, all of these different trends, traditions, but without being kind of completely diffused and doing nothing more than kind of just listing one title after the other? Now, that's the real danger, that it just becomes a shopping list of here's one text and here's another and here's another. So that's the hard thing, and it got harder as it went along, which is how do you organize this huge, growing and still ongoing? I guess when I started it, I wasn't sure I was going to go up to the present. And that's kind of how it has worked out. So, I mean, the last chapter is the 25th. It's a big, long chapter on the 21st century. But obviously, this is a work, the 21st century is a work in progress. So what I'm doing is, I guess, pointing to different directions and important moments, but knowing that it's still, the story of the US graphic novel is very much still unfolding. I think another thing that was difficult, and this comes back to the issue of size, you know, how do you narrow down? So there are certain, if you write a book called the US graphic novel, there are certain texts people definitely expect to find in it. At the same time, there are certain expectations about what's going to be in it that you, to an extent, you have to fulfill. But you also want to make people aware of great texts they've never heard of. I mean, that's that's part of what the pleasure is, you know, discovering things that are kind of off the radar and you want to share them with people. You want to say you really need to read this great comic. But there's also some of the comics that I focused on perhaps fall into neither of those categories. I just think they're the best case study to use as an example of what's happening at a particular moment in time. So there are these different imperatives, the kind of the giving, you know, covering the text that people want to see, introducing people to comics they never heard of, mm-hmm. and what make a good case study.
Could you give us some concrete examples, put some names to those?
Yeah, I think the very best, I mean, I think the year 1986 looms large in a lot of the historical scholarship. So across 86 to 87, Batman, The Dark Knight Returns is published, Watchmen, the first volume of Mouse, and something that I talk a bit more about in the book that's perhaps less recorded in the history is Harvey Pekar. They do, and there's a book edition of Harvey Pekar's American Splendor that I think actually was more prominent in people's thinking about graphic novels at the time than perhaps has been remembered really in the last 30, 40 years. But you know, where the sort of superhero genre is concerned, so these two big texts, Batman, The Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen, and I'm not going to write a book called the US graphic novel that doesn't mention these texts. That would be brave. I'm not that brave. So I do mention them, but I just kind of thought to myself, I asked myself, do I have anything particularly new or surprising to say about these texts? And I don't think I do. I certainly don't in the kind of space available. So what I did instead was as the kind of case study to think about that moment, I chose Give Me Liberty. So Give Me Liberty is sort of serialized and then published as a book edition very early 90s. So it's a science fiction story featuring, you know, the character Martha Washington, and it's written by Frank Miller, who wrote and drew Batman Dark Knight Returns, and the artist on Give Me Liberty, the pencil and the inker is Dave Gibbons, who did the artist on Watchmen. So this is how I approached this. I decided I would choose a text that has kind of biographical links, but it's less written about it. And I can still talk about postmodernism. I can still talk about kind of the revisionist term in comics, but talking perhaps about but doing that in a relation to a different text, you know, thinking about some of the issues it generates in terms of, say, science fiction or feminism or race. So that's an example of how I address the issue of, you know, people expect this book to perhaps cover certain texts, and I guess in a way I don't do that, but what I do do is hopefully investigate these issues by looking at a graphic novel that I think is proximate both in time but also what Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns were trying to do. So that will be the sort of the example of trying to come to terms with these competing kind of priorities for writing a book like this.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do?
Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah, and you're bringing in a lot of different perspectives. I wanted to ask you, as a scholar, in addition to having an audience of comic scholars, who else do you hope will read the book? Because you're bringing in a wide range of different perspectives.
I mean, I know it's a cliche. I do hope everyone will read the book. You know, it's priced in a way that's, you know, it's not a very, very expensive kind of university library only pricing. No, it's very much affordable. Yeah, for different pockets. So I guess I hope other comics scholars will read it, as you suggested. I hope anyone really with an interest in American comics will. I think anyone with an interest in American comics will enjoy it, and I definitely think that, you know, that there might be some people who have an encyclopedic knowledge of long form comics that have heard of all of these texts before. I think most people will discover new things. I think this is there are texts that I write about in the book that I think are, that I've never seen written about by any other scholars. So I do think I've uncovered some texts that most people will at least learn about at least one new graphic novel in the book.
I wanted to send it to the economists and sociologists personally. I think that would be an interesting new perspective on things. So we can dive into some details from the book really quickly. In the introduction, you write that to tell the story of the U.S. graphic novel is to give an account of the historical relationships between comics and adjacent cultural forms. Which were the most interesting relationships for you between comics and adjacent cultural forms that you ended up writing about? Did you have any that were favorite ties?
I mean, I think the one that springs out is the woodcut novels and posters.
I have to say emphatically, I loved that section. I was not aware of the silent novels and things like that, and I was writing it all down and looking it all up. I really appreciated the inclusion of that.
Thank you, Ellie. I do think it's that is just such an interesting bit of comics history. And I think some of it's, this is the classic example, I think some of it's known. I mean, people know Lindwald was a big woodcut artist. He sort of, I think, is known. But I think the extent to which there were a lot of other texts going on is bad, not completely appreciated. And it's not, I think, I use the term woodcut novel, but other scholars perhaps would use the words like wordless comics or whatever. And that might be better, actually, because these aren't all... I mean, obviously, the first thing anyone always says is that, oh, Lindwall didn't make woodcut novels. He made wood engraving novels. That's the main boring thing I will point out. I will say before anyone jumps in. Even though they were called, woodcut novels. But they're not just woodcut. It's not just lino cuts. Yeah, people are drawing, painting these long narratives in images, and they were published as books, and they usually have the word novel on the title. So I think that's really important, and I think that the thing that I want to do is to kind of connect this to particularly the poster art of the era, and talk about how the poster, particularly in the era of the motor car, posters had to become more and more kind of visually succinct. You know, they had to be able to capture attention in a single succinct image. Obviously, I think, that's not new to the history of graphic art, but it becomes, if you like, a new priority when you're trying to sell something, which could be a film or it could be, you know, a consumer goods, and you're trying to capture people's attention quickly, not least possibly on the side of an artwork. So I think what we have then is posters becoming more immediate and, I say, sort of concise in the way they're trying to make a point through a kind of condensed image. And I think the woodcut artists are doing something similar. I think this was intuited at a few different levels. And I think the example I use in the book is early on in God's Man by Linda Ward, which has a very...
I don't know, it's a telling incident where kind of there's an artist who sets up an easel in the street and everyone comes to look at what he's viewing, and then a kind of businessman comes and sells this image. And I think the way it kind of plays on ideas of art being kind of public and getting people's, you know, art can get people's attention in this big public way, but it risks becoming kind of privatized and sold off. I mean, these are the big concerns that runs not just through Lynn Ward's work, but really through so many of the woodcut novels. I mean, these are texts of that era. They are questions about relationship between questions of capitalism, of relationship between who owns the means of production, who gets paid to, you know, for their labor power to generate art. These run through so many of these texts. So I do think that's kind of really important moment we could talk about more in the history of comics, because they're, as in, Lynn Ward is really important, but he is one of a series of artists who are doing these things, not always in woodcut novels. I'll leap forward to the other side of the book. So the other thing to say would obviously, right now, comics are plugged into adjacent media in all sorts of ways. In terms of film and television, the need for content providers to find new source material means that, you know, streaming services not a month goes by when there isn't another rumor of a streaming service picking up a comic for adaptation. And I think this is important, not least economically, because the kind of the money that involves can really underwrite comics production. But obviously it can be quite constraining if it means that well-established characters have to be marshaled to stay on brand, as it were, because, you know, So it has both kind of enabling and constraining aspects to it, the very nature of online comics means that I hope I'm careful in the book to balance again the newness of what happens right now with online comics with the not so new. The example would be, you know, if you read a webcomic, there's a good chance that you'll be surrounded by adverts, that there'll be comments sort of below it that are commenting on the thing that you're reading. This is, I think, the sort of speed and immediacy is unprecedented. But the idea that readers and the people who make the comics would have a dialogue and that would inform the development of that comic, that's not new. You know, that goes back, you know, to the periodical comics, goes back to the newspaper strips. So I think what we have is things like web comics are a new configuration of relationships that we can see earlier in comics history. Pick up a comic book in the 1950s, it's probably going to have adverts between a lot of the pages. So the idea of the comics we read, the panels being juxtaposed with adverts, is definitely not new. But those adverts in the comic books tended not to move around or have audio. So that is something that we need to sort of factor in when we're thinking about what it means to read a comic now, and the way comics, how media transforms comics, both in the kind of there are at least two sides to this. So one is the media through which we get the comic, whether it's the printed page or the screen, that structures our interaction, but also I think storytelling itself. And this might throw me back to the start of the book, when I talk about how the development of comics as a sort of storytelling language takes place in relationship to silent film, and the way in which the single shot, single reel, sort of humorous film, which is really the first type of comic fiction filmmaking, is this sort of, is, you know, one reel gag films. But all sorts of biographical connections to comic strip artists at the time, and you can see very clearly the sort of the back and forth borrowing of stock scenarios, but also the very way in which the cinematic shots can be compared to the comics page is there's a congruence there, that we can observe. So the whole adjacent media thing is it's going on all the way through comics history, and often the ingredients are pretty similar, but it's the configuration that changes.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it, that the configuration is changing, these forces are changing, but there are some of these key qualities that run as a red thread through everything. And you said that you were inspired by the sociological turn in comic studies. I wanted to know, I don't want to put you on the spot to be predictive, but where do you see this line of research leading in the future as all these new media are coming in and the environment is changing?
I mean, I think we will definitely see more audience studies. And so I think we will see increasing use of surveys and interviews to understand what people do when they read a comic. I think we're already seeing developments in terms of sort of cognitive studies partly that level of what does the eye do when confronted with a comic, and does that change? Does it change if you're reading print versus screen, for example? But definitely, I think we'll see more examinations of how fans take comics, remake them, the role of fans as cultural producers and consumers. So I think we'll only see more of that sort of research. What I'd like to see would be more research into the production side of comics, and dare I say, more research into the historically the production of comics. I think this is something that we really don't have that much of, or in some ways we've got, what we do have a lot of are memoir and recollections. So people that edited, wrote, drew comics, through the 20th century, we've definitely got their comments, maybe to the fan press or say in memoirs. So we definitely have their observations on their experiences, work, maybe working in a particular company, in particular offices. I think what perhaps we certainly have yet to sort of marshal together into a body to be analysed is the kind of the documentation. And by this, I guess I mean all sorts of things. I mean sales figures. I mean discussions about advertising. I mean the kind of the journey that comics take through, particularly in mainstream comics, particularly that journey from scripts that were edited that then get penciled and inked and lettered, colors added, that these I think the way in which that took place, the practice of making comics, we have, for different kind of individuals, we can often reconstruct that, but the way it might work within particular companies, I think we could do more to kind of understand that and how they work. So how companies worked would be a way of saying this. I definitely don't just mean Marvel and DC. I mean, there are so many small companies that I want to know how they worked. The companies that just lived for 10 years and published 40 comics, but I still want to know, so why, how did they get together? Where did the money come from? What sort of assessment of profit went into, deciding to print this comic? Was any assessment of profit went into making this comic? So I think that what we might call the relations of production, I guess, the how people got together to make things happen, I think we can. I'd love to see more on
how that takes place, particularly in the context of, you know, individual companies.
Uh-huh. And can I ask you, because this is a point you bring up in your book, which I found very titillating hearing about, maybe the, and I'd like to ask you about it a little bit more later on, but about corruption and a certain amount of manipulation and sales numbers and things like that. So from the perspective of a historian doing archival work, how do you find access to these materials and assess reliability and work with those when the environment might not be conducive to answers in some cases?
Yeah, it's really, really hard. And you know, having just said that it's very hard to get hold of things like sales figures and company documents, it's not impossible. But I have had, you know, I've gone to an archive, I've got what looks to me like documented sales figures for a particular graphic novel. And then I've interviewed the publisher, who says, "Oh no, you can't trust them. Those aren't the actual sales figures. I don't know at what point those figures were collected, but they don't reflect the actual sales." And to be honest, that happens quite a lot, really, where you'll find a letter, you'll find documentary evidence, and then you'll interview the person who wrote it, and they'll contest, if you like, the very document that they wrote, which is really hard. So basically, it's just basically about corroboration. It's about trying to kind of, it's that kind of parallax view, right? You're trying to get lots of different views on the same moment, text, and then hopefully through those different views, you can work out a story that is as plausible as possible with the evidence you have. I mean, this is kind of the great postmodern conundrum, that the more views you have on an event, you don't get close to the truth, you just have more versions. So it is really hard. It is about that sort of kind of just judging the veracity of a text based on both not just the text itself, but also, you know, asking those questions, you know, how is it being preserved? Why is it being preserved? You know, what texts haven't been preserved? You know, so I've got these sales figures, but I don't have these. Does that matter? Just hold a lot of different information in your head, but I'd also say this partly. There are cases where you've just got to share your own uncertainty with the reader. That there are times where you feel confident enough to say, okay, I think it's this many sales, or okay, I think it was released on this day, not this one. That's the other thing. You feel like adverts and official release dates and copyright don't always line up. But sometimes you have to share with the reader, this bit of evidence says this bit of evidence says this. I think we can, there are multiple conclusions that could be drawn. These are those multiple conclusions. And then you have to sort of, you live with the uncertainty without trying to kind of, smooth it off and pretend it's not there. So sometimes you've just got to share your own confusion and conflicting evidence with the reader.
Yeah, the transparency about the process is equally interesting, at least for me. So one of the questions related to this that you ask is, who pays for online comics, to bring us back to the present? How fast is this changing, and what influence do you see this having on the comics being created? You touched on this a little bit, but if we could go deeper into that.
Yeah, I touched on it a little, and I think I'm glad I don't make any more statements on it, because the one thing I'm sure about is that whatever I write is part of a fast-changing scene. I mean, one of the things that I say in the book is I talk about historical issues with getting people to pay for online content. You know, that people are used to things being, you know, if it's on the internet, they want it to be free. I'm not sure that's true anymore. I mean, I guess the issue is it's true, but it's becoming less true by the day. You know, streaming services, I think, really have increasingly normalizing the ideas that people will pay for things that they don't own, that they are effectively renting. You know, it is you know, Charles Hatfield's Alternative Comics, which is a terrific work of scholarship, talks about the kind of the circulating library and the kind of the influence of that on, like I said, the 19th century circulating libraries and how that might help us understand comic shops. I mean, I think in a way it's one of the one of those things that those sort of circulating libraries you know, remind us of, you know, from the 19th century, and is that, you know, people are very, very willing to pay for access to texts and not to own them outright. So I think even more than when US graphic novel came out is that the that this is a model for the future, that thing people are willing to pay money, and Patreon I guess would be part of this as well, to have access to a body of text that is there as long as you are subscribing or paying contributing funds. So it's definitely a complicated picture. It changes a lot. I talk about this a bit in the book, but I mean it's clearly comics are being available in multiple versions, and so it might be that via Patreon you read a comic that's made available by a comics creator who then makes the same comic available for free, perhaps a few months later on a website or social media, that then might be published, or it might be published in as a comic book even earlier than that, but then it will be republished as a book. So what we have is the same comic is available by different media and different platforms in multiple ways. Now, you could obviously, the good thing about this is that this means that there are many different money streams that creators can access, but we might not be talking about particularly sort of reliable or permanent money streams. I think we're also, and I think this is the really, really key thing, it is about well-established creators can, I think this works well for creators who have very large, well, in fact, not even very large, but certainly very dedicated followers, you know, fans who want to sort of follow their work and really want to see what they do next. So I think Kickstarter, Patreon, obviously they do different things. I think these are working well for creators with dedicated fan bases who particularly are willing to put money up front for something that they don't know what it's going to look like. Because if you like, that creator's brand is so strong, people trust the fact that it'll be both high quality and it'll be what they enjoy. So I feel that the system certainly works well for both innate in user. You talked about what sort of comics get made. Well, I think the answer is for well-established creators, they've perhaps got more freedom than before, and the sort of funds to do it. My feeling is this is very, very hard for new comics creators, that building up an audience does take time. And dare I say, I can think of some very, very successful creators whose reputations are almost solely based on web comics. But I certainly think it's creators who might have built up their reputation in mainstream comics, or if not mainstream comics, they're in periodicals. That seems to be one road to success. That you build a reputation working perhaps with established characters, certainly with established publishers, and that gives you the exposure to build a following that you can then take with you to fund projects through things like Kickstarter. And I will say, this again, in the spirit of a different version of something we've seen before,
And this is kind of like in the 70s and 80s, you know, the really best-selling independent comics creators were the ones who'd built reputations at Marvel and DC and then moved to companies that would give them more creative control, royalty payments, ownership of the characters they created. So I think something like this has been seen, you know, I think it's structurally similar to what we've seen before, but again, with different media and arranged in a slightly different way.
Brave new world in some ways.
It is. I mean, it's the sort of thing, I imagine I could easily, in 10 years' time, do a revised edition and write a completely different last chapter.
Sounds like a new book project. Keep that in your back pocket. And can I ask you on a personal level, since you're covering so much in this book, was there any particular comic that caught your eye or captured your heart that you really got attached to in the historic interview overview? My goodness. Okay.
I mean, I do like, in terms of giving you a very obvious answer, I did enjoy reading a lot of Marvel comics from the 60s. I wasn't necessarily planning to do that much on them, but I actually did a minor operation, but it did mean that I sort of was going to be in bed for a couple of weeks. My university library has some of those, you know, the huge editions that have got sort of 25 issues each in, you know, and they also have the letters pages, which is great. So I got out a load of these, and knowing that I would be in bed for a couple of weeks, I got loads of these out, and it was, dare I say, it was a pleasant convalescence, making my way steadily through, you know, issue after issue of Fantastic Four. I wasn't planning to really write on Marvel comics, but this moment made me think, do you know what, I think there might be a place for these comics, or a more fuller place maybe in the book. I also write a bit about Samuel Delaney and Howard Chaykin's Empire from 1978. I think this is such a fascinating text. I think because it sometimes badged as a visual novel, it's less concretely located in histories of the US graphic novel, although it's a comic. It's very clearly a comic. The thing that is fascinating about Empire is... Samuel Delaney obviously is a very eminent science fiction writer. A lot of the interest in, say, kind of mathematical models and things like that have made their way into this text. The story itself is a kind of science fiction. It's rebels fighting an evil empire. But Howard Chaykin's produced, you know, some really beautiful painted images. So it's very visually dynamic, but the thing that makes it particularly interesting for me is that it was very intrusively edited by Byron Preece, who was the publisher. And I talk about this a little bit about this in the book. I talk about it elsewhere as well. For me, the thing that is fascinating about this text is that it is, you can see where the publisher, where the editor has change the text. You can see where, the way panels have been cut actually cuts. You know, the way someone took scissors to them. You can see that. So it's a fascinating text because if you are interested in how things get made, then this is a very, very good example of that, because we can see just how manipulated it was before it was published, and they don't do. I won't say these changes do a lot of favours for the story, but they are very interesting. You know, they are very interesting. And I will say, I still think, as even though the text has been manipulated, you can still, you know, Chaykin's art still looks great. You know, it's still it's a very bold, experimental texts. And in some ways, the editing perhaps makes it experimental in ways that aren't intended, as a kind of avant-garde experiment in narrative. But it's still, I think, it still looks great. It's still incredibly impressive. And so I think Empire is one of those texts that I think, yeah, there's even more to be said. And it's got this fascinating story behind it.
I love the phrase intrusive editing. I feel like that needs to be used more. Great. So I think you should research and write about that a bit more. I'd love to ask you if your ideas have developed at all since the book, and what projects are you currently working on? Maybe a further longer study on Empire.
So the thing I'm actually working on right now is about photocopying in comics. So I thought it was going to be an article, but as I started writing it quite recently, I mean, I'm definitely well beyond the length of an article. So perhaps it's a small book. So this will be a book on, yeah, photocopying. A lot of the scholarship calls it Xeroxing, because the first photocopies are developed by the company that became Xerox Corporation. One of the main things is how people make comics with photocopiers. So it's about mini comics and about how, you know, running paper, you know, you run a comic through a photocopier, you know, you fold it, you staple it, you have a comic that you can, you know, give to people, you can sell. So it's part of that. So it involves a lot of research in things like sort of folklore studies of how people have used photocopies in offices, kind of ethnographies of photocopy and repair people. So it really is about photocopying. I'm going to read a poem about photocopying just after this. It really is about photocopiers and photocopies, and how comics creators have used photocopies. And I mean, I don't think I want to go too far into photocopies used in art. So clearly, sort of found images, collages being used in people. Someone like Jack Kirby's doing this. I'm not sure I'm going to go that far, but it does include photocopying as depicted in comics. So I'm looking at comics where people, where photocopies break down, or when they're stapling their own comics. So it's a bit, in some ways, it's your classic comics. What do comics tell you about making comics? By the images and the words. So that's one of the things I'm working on. And I'm also working on a book about underground artists and working in non-underground context. So this is going really back to 60s, 70s, 80s. And there are a few different angles, but it's about underground creators who then perhaps might work for, let's say, you know, let's say they become, they work for Marvel, or I'm looking at the National Lampoon magazine, and how that became a place where lots of underground comics got published, and Sharif Benekin, who's an underground comics artist who becomes an art editor at the National Lampoon. So that's another sort of one of the case studies. I'm also looking at how underground comics were reprinted by trade presses. And this happens really early on. So the first, you know, you could walk into a bookshop and buy a book of underground comics in 1967. Now, at this point, there were very, very few actual underground comic books, if you like. So I really want to sort of think about this moment of, well, this relationship between underground comics and other sorts of forms of publishing that we wouldn't call underground. But what I don't really want to do is tell a story in which the underground comics become mainstreamed or co-opted. Although that's relevant, but I really want to find a different way to think about these relationships, partly because I think the things like the chronologies don't always match up that way. I think it would be wrong to assume that underground creators lost control of their work once they move to other publishers. I think what I'm seeing actually, I'm really not sure that is, that's definitely not the story that it looks like I'm going to tell. So it's about the undergrounds and when it appears in places that aren't obviously underground. And I also want to write a book on 90s British alternative comics, or from the late 80s and the 90s. And that in a way, that's a kind of a passion project I've been sitting on for many a year, and maybe sitting on it for many a year yet. But I do want to shine a light on a period of incredibly rich comics production. And I think, generally speaking, although I do read a lot of comics, I don't often write about comics that I sort of read. I take pleasure from what I do, but that's not the same as saying I write about comics that I kind of have this deep emotional investment in. But I do have a deep emotional investment in 90s British comics. But also, I think on one level, I think these are texts that just aren't in histories. So I sometimes say this to sort of really, scholars I consider to be brilliant, eminent, well-read scholars, and I reel off what I think are the better-known alternative comics written in the 90s, and they've not heard of them. So I do think, but they're really innovative. They're very, they're stunning experiments with form and layouts, and with materiality. I think a really diverse range of creators is starting to make comics in the 90s. I also think region is really important. And this is not so different from work I've done in the past. So this does mean where do these stories take place? So we're talking about comics that might be set in Devon or set in Newcastle or set in the Welsh borders, and they both use very recognisable sort of skylines and use local accents in the comics. So part of it is the stories they tell, but there is a kind of political economy aspect to this as well. So there's definitely a relationship between alternative comics creators and, say, local comic shops or their local comics convention. And one of the things that this project will do is think about the economics of that. You know, how important is the local comic shop for selling copies of this, self-publisher's work? Is it the case that, effectively the local comic shop is the only retailer for this comic? Or, which I don't think is usually, often these are comics going around the world, but it is working out just how important are regional retail outlets for comics production in Britain in the 90s. So that is, I think it's a little way off yet, but that is a project I do want to make my way round to eventually.
Fingers crossed to hear those projects develop and get some funding. That would be great. So it sounds like you have a lot to keep working on, and I'm going to thank you very much for your time today. I know you're busy. So Dr. Paul Williams, thank you so much for joining us today to talk to us about your book, The US Graphic Novel.
Thank you very much, Ellie. Thanks for having me.